loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. President Obama hosts NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the White House on Monday, with President Obama announcing earlier this year that the United States would be quadrupling its military budget in Europe in 2017. What is the future of the alliance? Is NATO outdated? We are joined today for the full hour by Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst and now political activist and journalist, writer. Welcome back, Ray McGovern.
Most welcome.
So what is the summit about? It looks like it's about NATO expansion, but talk about it if you would.
Well, NATO has been in dire straits until a couple of years ago when all hell broke loose in the Ukraine. Before then, NATO arms producers and arms traders were having a real tough time selling the notion that there was a threat out there, that they needed to produce more arms and sell more arms to counter. Once the West launched successfully coup in Ukraine, that is on the 22nd of February 2014, the legitimate government was overthrown. It was a putsch, it was a coup. Once that happened, and once Russia, to nobody's surprise who knew anything about Russia, reincorporated Crimea into Russia, then you had the kind of tension. Then you had a kind of threat from Russia. That you could build, for example, the main European battle tank, which had been sort of dormant between the consortium of German and French manufacturing companies. So what's happening now is there's a real, quote-unquote real, it's really an imagined threat from Russia, where everyone has sort of broken into step. And there's lots of reason to spend more money. Now, NATO, if they're smart, they'll be as stingy as they have been in the past. But there's great pressure for the United States. And the wonder of all wonders, in my view, is that 71 years after the end of World War II, NATO members, including chief members like Germany and France, are still acting like, well, I won't say children anymore, sort of like adolescents. They can't seem to break free. They can't seem to act like adults, because if they acted like adults, they would know that the coup in Kiev was what George Friedman called the most blatant coup in history, and that they're not going to be dragged around to do the United States' bidding with sanctions on Russia and all the other things, spending more money on defense, because they're grown-ups now, because they can see what's happening, because they know about the military-industrial congressional complex in the United States, and they could say no for once.
Let me ask you, Ray McGovern, about German and Russian relations, because it may be at the heart of what's going on, or certainly one of the central features. Historically, Russia and Germany had relations. I mean, when you go back through history, even after the Russian Revolution in February and then October 1917, when the Western world was largely imposing sanctions or invading Russia following the Russian Revolution, Germany, under the terms of the Versailles Treaty, which had been humbled economically, imposed with its own sanctions, reparations, brought into ruins, even then in 1922-23, even with the then demonized Soviet government, there was the beginning of what seemed to be a realignment of Germany in the direction of Russia. I mean, is it your view that absent NATO, absent the pressure of the United States, absent the discipline imposed on the alliance allies by the United States, that if there was a relaxation of real tensions, a real relaxation between the West and Russia, would Germany start to reorient to towards Russia. And is that something that the United States is actually worried about? Is that why the United States, for instance, still has troops in Germany 71 years after the end of World War II?
Well, the United States, of course, has troops in about 140 countries. But Germany still has, I think, about 38,000. It's a vestige of World War II, and one that the West Germans and the East Germans and the Germans as a people just can't seem to shake. They have been harmed economically by the sanctions. When were those sanctions imposed?
You mean the sanctions against Russia?
Against Russia, yeah. I mean, the sanctions were ostensibly to retaliate against Russia or, quote, invading, end quote, Ukraine and Crimea. Now, when that wasn't enough, when the Europeans were smart enough to realize that the Russians already had 25,000 troops allowed in Crimea under a bilateral treaty with Ukraine, and when they saw that the Russians really didn't invade the eastern part of Ukraine, as General Breedlove charged and made believe, then they needed something else. And the something else came on the 20th of July, 2014, in the form of the shootdown of a Malaysian airline, MH17, immediately blamed on the Russians, or the pro-Russians, or the Russian separatists, or the Russian this, Russian this, Russian missile, when in reality, no proof was adduced. Now, I mention this because John Kerry got up and said, oh, we have very good technical information. We have telemetry. We know exactly where the missile was fired from and when it was fired. It was just when the plane went down. Well, you know, he hasn't been able to show us that. He hasn't even been able or willing to show that to the Dutch, who are the ostensible investigators here. So when an American citizen lost in this terrible crash or shootdown, when his father asked the Dutch, well, have the Americans given you that information that John Kerry bragged about 3 days after the incident? And the Dutch said, well, no, they haven't given us. And the reason they haven't given it is because it doesn't exist. John Kerry, not for the first time, is lying through his teeth. Why do I mention this? Because it was just a week or two later that finally the Europeans were browbeat into saying Putin bad, Putin bad, Putin very, very bad, Putin have no shirt on sometimes, Putin ride a horse with no shirt on, Putin shoot down MH17. Now we cannot withstand U.S. pressures for economic sanctions against Russia. Now those sanctions, Russia has survived those sanctions as we knew it would. What about the Europeans? What about all those farmers? What about all those Europeans that trade with Russia? They have been hurt. And what amazes me to this day is that Angela Merkel and Hollande and the others can withstand the pressure within their own societies in a democracy where the people realize how they've been had and how they're doing the bidding in the United States vis-a-vis Russia. And this is going to persist for another couple of years, I predict. So, answer to your question, you started out by saying, is NATO outdated? Well, NATO was outdated when the Berlin Wall fell and when Gorbachev made that deal with the United States that he would not use the 230,000, count them, 230,000 highly trained Russian troops in East Germany to put down the revolt, okay? The quid pro quo was not to move NATO one inch toward the east from Germany. And as you could see, President Clinton and his successors forgot about that quid pro quo. And in just a few years, NATO doubled in size with every nation, every new nation joining it, coming to the east of the original 12.
I mean, when NATO was first formed, I believe it was 1948, you'll know with certainty, there was then formed the Warsaw Pact. So you had the two major anchoring powers of two different global camps, one anchored in Washington, which had become the dominant power in the capitalist world, and then you had the Soviet Union anchoring what became known as the socialist bloc countries. You had the Berlin Crisis of 1948, all other kinds of manifestations of tension. There were, of course, then the Chinese Revolution in 1949. It became the global struggle between what the West called freedom and what and communism. Okay, so the Warsaw Pact though is gone. I mean, the Warsaw Pact and this in the NATO were the mirrors. They were parallel organizations. They were organizations purportedly of defense or mutual defense amongst the allies within those two camps. So how does it really get to be justified that after the Soviet Union is gone, after the demise by 1992, that there should not have been the dissolution of NATO? I mean, it seems to me that it was really just the essence of political opportunism that this could be continued. On what basis?
Well, that's just it. On what basis? Well, if you look at the situation, you have George H.W. Bush, the president, when the Berlin Wall fell down, reassuring Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, his foreign minister, that we would not take advantage of the disarray in the Warsaw Pact. And the promise was made, and we have this recorded not only in U.S. documents, but in West German, now German documents. Foreign Minister Genscher, he repeated the promise, and so did the head of NATO, not one inch to the east of West Germany, of Germany. Now, this was a big promise, and is the only way that the Russians in their right mind would consent to the reunification of Germany. And bear in mind, we don't have to go back to the 16th, 15th century when the Teutonic Knights were invading Russia. We can go right back to Napoleon, or let's go to Hitler, okay? How many people did Russia lose in World War II? If we ask that around here, nobody knows the answer. The answer is 26, 27 million, okay, million people. And so this was a big, big deal. And nobody wanted the reunification of Germany, not the East, not the West. And when I heard that Gorbachev was going to consent to it, I tell you, I didn't want it either. I'd lived there 5 years. I knew my history. So for the Russians to make that concession was a very big deal, and the quid that they got for that quo was violated very handily and very quickly. Now, why was it violated? Well, when Bill Clinton came in, you know, he's running for election and re-election, and he really liked to have the East European emigres like Brzezinski and like Albright cheering him on. And he wanted to appeal to those people who were afraid that the Russians could do what they did in the past with the Warsaw Pact. And so that was part of it. The other part had to do with the fact that the agreement was not written down. This agreement, this solemn promise by the U.S. recorded in many documents, was not written down as a kind of aid memoir or a treaty of any kind. And I had the unusual opportunity to ask a professor, now a professor, who was a key advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev during those very, very important years, okay? And I said, now, why wasn't it not written down? And his name is Kuvaldin, okay? A really, really good professor and a great advisor. So we're talking about when Jim Baker came to Moscow and they agreed, okay, to make this quid pro quo. I said, why wasn't it written down? He looked at me and he said, Ray, two reasons, you know, on the surface. One is the Warsaw Pact still existed, okay? And, you know, if we're talking about Germany, it probably would have been nice to include the Germans in this deal, right? I mean, you know, we hadn't even talked to Genscher yet. And so those were the obvious, immediate, proximate reasons. But you know what the real reason was, Ray? He looked me straight in the eye and he said, we trusted you. Wow. So promises are important, especially promises between the top leaders of countries. They were violated, and NATO grew apace, and by the time that Yeltsin, the clown that became the head of what was left of Russia at the time, by the time he left office, the country had been plundered, the country was in disarray, and we thought we could do anything we wanted. And when I mention that, I like to refer to the first Gulf War. Okay, we're talking the end of 1990, beginning of 1991, January and February, we won this victorious victory over a dilapidated Iraqi army, and everyone was applauding everything. And finally, Paul Wolfowitz, who was sort of the author of some of this, he was visited by General Wesley Clark. And Wesley Clark said, "Good job, Paul. Wow, you really showed your military might." And Paul says, "Yeah, the military victory was important. But you know what the most important thing was?" And Clark looked and goes, "No, there's something more important." And Paul Wolfowitz said, and I quote, "Yeah, the main lesson is that we can do what we want and the Russians won't stop us." Now, Paul Wolfowitz added, "This is not going to be forever. We probably only have maybe 10 years or so before we're going to meet more sustained and more defense-capable resistance here. So let's make use of these years." That was 1991. 2003, we invaded Iraq on false pretenses. We would not have done that if the Soviet Union still existed. Why do we do it? In large measure because, quote, "The Russians won't stop us," end quote. Now, Ukraine, the Russians could, the Russians would, the Russians did stop us. That was one regime change too far, and that's the different strategic equation right now. No matter how many more tanks or armored personnel carriers and so forth, the U.S. and NATO ready at Russia's border, everyone knows that this benefits only the arms manufacturers, the arms purveyors and sellers, and that no one's going to try to give Russia a bloody nose unless they run off half-cocked. And I dearly hope that the General Breedloves of this world will retire and slip away and silently slip away, as MacArthur once said. And we'll get some judicious people up there who will not provoke Russia into reacting, as I know they will, if they feel threatened on their immediate frontier.
We are talking to Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst, today a writer, a critic of U.S. foreign policy, and an activist. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking with Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst, now a political activist, a journalist, writer. We're talking about the summit that begins Monday, the hosting by President Obama of NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg. He's meeting with him at the White House. We're talking about NATO. NATO continued to exist even after the demise of the Soviet Union, after the end of the Warsaw Pact, the socialist bloc military alliance that mirrored NATO. We're talking with Ray McGovern about why NATO, in fact, not only exists, but expanded following the demise of the Soviet Union. Ray McGovern, before we left for a break, we were talking about Paul Wolfowitz and his conclusions around the time of the first Gulf War. That would have been January, February 1991. The U.S. assembled a coalition of the willing, I guess, at that time, 26 nations that began the bombing of Iraq. Finally, Iraq, which had been almost completely crippled militarily, withdrew from Kuwait. George H.W. Bush was the president of the United States. You mentioned James Baker, who was then Bush's Secretary of State. Wolfowitz was making the point that you brought out before the break, that the Russians weren't going to stop the United States in carrying out a war against Iraq, a traditional ally of the Soviet Union and of Russia, because of the new orientation of the Russian government. And Wolfowitz, as you made the point, said, "We have a brief time before Russia gets back on its feet, and then we will not be able to sort of move unfettered in the world as a unipolar power." I want to talk about Wolfowitz and the neoconservatives, because Wolfowitz was the writer of the white paper, I believe, that surfaced in the New York Times around 1992, whereby that section of the U.S. foreign policy establishment made the point that following the demise of the Soviet Union, the U.S. must signal all other nations that no, quote, competitor, close quote, would be tolerated, and that it would be through the exercise of U.S. military power, which was by far greater and far greater than any other country, that the U.S. would maintain its sort of unipolar supremacy. Now we have, or did have in 2003, 12 years later, the invasion of Iraq, the full-scale invasion, not just the bombing as happened in 1991, but the effort by the United States government militarily to send hundreds of thousands of troops to smash, destroy the Iraqi government with the hope, I guess, of creating a puppet regime. Talk about how that impacted on Russia's political military calculations. And also, just before that, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was the agency through which the United States came in to Afghanistan, far from the North Atlantic. Talk about those two things together, if you could.
Yeah, I had to consult the globe in my office to make sure that I remembered where Afghanistan was, because it didn't seem to be anywhere near the North Atlantic. And I was a bit relieved to see that I had been right. But the quagmire or the question remains, why is NATO involved in Afghanistan? That's another, maybe another subject for another time. Getting back to Wolfowitz, yeah, that document in 1992 was the defense planning guidance. In other words, this is a big deal. This is how the Defense Department, spending its $500 billion at that time, would orient its policies and its manufacturing and its selling of arms. And you quoted it quite correctly. We would let no competitor arise that would rival us in any way militarily. Now, that's 1992, but it has antecedents in the immediate post-war period. 1948, George Kennan, the author of the containment policy, used to be my hero. Well, he wrote the first policy planning guidance paper for the Department of State, and what it said was, you know, we ended up after this war with 50% control over the world's natural resources. But we comprise only about 6% of the world's population. So, if you're interested in how we should develop our policy, well, that's simple. We have to do everything we can to maintain this disproportionality, to make sure that we get more than our share, because after all, we are the sole indispensable country in the world. And so what that means is we have to dispense with vague concepts like civil liberties and democracy and all that kind of when we need to, because it's going to take not only soft power, it's going to take hard power. And that's a virtual quote. So fast forward to 92, now we emerge as the only real superpower with all the weapons that we need and then some, and now we can implement that with military power. Wolfowitz was prescient in a sense. We got away, that is, the United States got away with Iraq, got away with Afghanistan. But, you know, I think putting myself in the shoes of the Russian leaders, I think that they were pretty much convinced that given their experience in the quagmire Afghanistan, that it might be interesting just to kind of count our blessings, not get involved, and see what a mess the United States will create in these countries. And indeed, if there's anything that the Kremlin and, God help us, Osama bin Laden agreed on from a strategic point of view, is that the United States would become terribly overreached, would spend not billions but trillions of dollars on these overextended commitments, and indeed that's exactly what happened. Now today, I was amazed with all this talk about four times increasing expenses in NATO by four times. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, said, well, that be as it may, we in Russia are reducing our defense expenses by 5% this year, like, you know, 2016. Oh.
That's not making headlines here.
No, it's not. But, you know, as my good friend Chuck Spinney, who knows a lot more about this kind of thing than I do, he wrote an article right after that, and the title was, Thank God for China. Now, what's the meaning of that? Well, if our military-industrial congressional complex can no longer point to Russians, oh, look, they're increasing their defense, but we got to meet them. Well, thank goodness there's a China out there. We can easily just pivot to the east, as they say. Originally, Hillary Clinton's idea, by the way, not Obama's. And we'll find, you know, we'll go in search of dragons or enemies to destroy. Oh, how about China? Let's encircle China. And that's precisely what's going on now. So the military-industrial people are just as happy as larks because they've got new potential enemies to build up against and to fund arms to meet these challenges. So it's not really funny, but it is odd. And the last thing I'll inject into this strategic equation is something that has transcendent importance in my view, and that is, and maybe this comes out of my experience in the 60s and 70s when I was the chief analyst on Sino-Soviet relations. Okay, now, if you put yourself back then, there were lots of people saying, oh, this dispute between China and Russia, it's not real. They're both commies, for Pete's sake. McGovern, you're being taken in. Well, I wasn't being taken in. It was real. It was so real that the Chinese prevented the transit of Russian equipment and arms to the common socialist power, North Vietnam, and fighting the war against it. It was very real. And we made a mistake in those years. We were so confident that the Russians and Chinese hated each other so much that they would hate each other forever. And that was wrong. Never say forever. Look at it now. In those days, the trade balance was $400 million a year. Now, last time I checked, it's about 50 or 60 billion with a B.
The irony being that when they were both led by communist parties, the ideological, political differences became so pronounced and also transformed into a state-to-state dispute, not only an ideological dispute, that the U.S. was able at that time to take advantage of the Sino-Soviet split. I mean, they were able to, in essence, sort of pit both of them against each other through different sort of symmetry between the United States and Soviet leaders, and symmetry later in the 1970s between Nixon and Mao Zedong. And then eventually the Chinese orientation was very, very anti-Soviet, and that was a principal card that Ronald Reagan played. But you're right. I mean, here's the irony is that today Russia and China are expanding trade and also expanding all kinds of cooperation. And it seems that what the United States has demonstrated in the past 25 years since the demise of the Soviet Union and the demise of the Warsaw Pact and the expansion of the NATO alliance and its tasks and its geography is that the United States, under the aegis or direction of the Wolfowitzes, the neocons, and perhaps now that's the majority of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, like Hillary Clinton and perhaps Barack Obama, that the U.S. Global march is actually a clear threat to both of them. I mean, it really is the irony of ironies.
Well, you're correct, Brian, and I would agree completely. Henry Kissinger, whatever else he was, including a war criminal, was very adept at playing Russia and China off one against the other. And I was personal witness to that. I was chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch. I saw the Russians being really hard-nosed on things like strategic arms negotiations, on things like Berlin. And all of a sudden, when Kissinger and then Nixon went to Beijing, they all loosened up. Strategic arms limitations treaties became possible, and I had the luck to be there in Moscow in 72 when the main ones were signed, including the ABM treaty, which the younger Bush...
That's the anti-ballistic missile treaty.
Yeah, and that was an incredible force for stabilization for many decades. And so, you know, I watched this happen, and then I watched the logjam over Berlin break. The Russians leaned on the East Germans, said, look, let's do a deal here so there's not a threat to the transit of Western material and air traffic into Berlin. And that ended. We got a quadripartite agreement. Now, the situation now is so ironically different. It's the Chinese and the Russians, not overtly like Kissinger did, but sort of subtly, are getting each other, are having each other's back, as we say in the vernacular here. Why do I say that? What have the Chinese said about Ukraine? Now, in the day, as they say, you know, the old days, now the Chinese really don't like people annexing other people's territory. The Chinese would be up in arms. They'd be yelling and screaming. People's Daily would be out every blasting Putin for doing what he did. Not a word of that from the Chinese. So what we have here is a pronounced switch in the strategic equation where Putin can say, yeah, I'm having economic problems. Part of it is because of the sanctions, but not all of it. Most of it is the oil. That'll come back. But meanwhile, I'm not going to be really stupid. I'm not going to increase my defense expenditures. China has my back. You know, if a person like General General Breedlove, the Air Force general who's head of NATO, okay, if he had the stupidity to start a clash with Russia in Europe, guess what the Chinese would do? Well, I'll tell you what they would do. You would see some challenges out there in the South China Sea. You would see some bellicose gestures toward our allies, Japan and others. You would see the Chinese filling in behind, and they are a force now to be reckoned with. And so the strategic equation has changed, but the sorrowful thing, Ryan, is that nobody here in Washington seems to understand that.
We're talking to Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst, an expert on the Soviet Union and on Eastern and Central Europe. We're talking about the meeting that's taking place on Monday at the White House between President Obama and Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. He is the leader of NATO. We're going to have to go, Ray McGovern, to a break in a minute, but I want to read to you before we do that an announcement. This is an official announcement about this meeting between President Obama and the NATO General Secretary. And then when we come back, I want you to comment on it. It says, President Barack Obama hosts NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at the White House Monday in a visit that underscores the importance the United States places on the transatlantic bond that NATO embodies and on a North Atlantic alliance whose full adaptation to a changing strategic environment will ensure that the alliance continues to uphold international order and advance the interests of the United States and all NATO members and partners. They will discuss the progress in the international effort to degrade and destroy the Islamic State group, the role of NATO is playing in alleviating the refugee and migrant crisis, and preparation for a July 2016 NATO summit in Warsaw, Poland, where that's the Warsaw Pact back then, including allied efforts to reinforce deterrence in Europe, address instability on Europe's periphery, and strengthen NATO's base of capabilities and partnerships. Of course, Ray McGovern, when we come back, we know that that's carefully parsed language. I want to get your view of what they really mean in these official documents. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking to Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst. He's a journalist. He has raymcgovern.com website. Go there to see his writings. We're talking about the summit that's taking place Monday. It's not really a summit. It's a meeting between President Obama and the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. Ray McGovern, before we took a short break, I read to you what the White House is saying about this meeting. Carefully chosen language. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I've looked at the language, Brian. It comes right out of the draw, a NATO summit. It's boilerplate. Let me tell you what I think are the real issues that will be addressed. First off, refugees. I was in Germany for a week on a speaking tour in September of last year during the first wave of the refugees from Turkey. I saw them at the Bahnhof stations and so forth. The press was full. The West German and the East German, the whole German press was full of articles about refugees. What are we going to do with them? Is Angela right in saying we take them? We can't take them. We take them. Not one word. Not one word, Brian, about how come there are so many refugees? You know, why are they all fleeing Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan? Well, you know, it was a bizarre manifestation of how tightly controlled the German press is, as well as the UK press, as well as the US press.
That's the free press, right?
Yeah, right. So-called free in quotes. I mean, what you have here is the result of George Bush's monumental mistake of invading Iraq, waging continual war under Obama in Afghanistan, having Secretary of State Hillary Clinton start a war in Libya. I mean, the place is in chaos. And all the Germans can say is, oh, what should we do? How many should we let in? Should we, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I saw this on the ground and I said to myself, wow, you know, when are they ever going to grow up? When are they ever going to say to the United States, look, if you hadn't started this war on false pretexts, we wouldn't be in this fix now. Let's see if we can tamp down the war. Let's see if we can stop the conditions that promote or that give rise to these refugees. None of that. So what do we have? Well, we have Syria, and that's a real problem. And that's what's going to be discussed here. To their credit, and we have to give credit where it's due, when President Putin told our president, President Obama, on the 28th of September at the UN, look, Mr. President, you may not like this, but the reason we put all those aircraft and other equipment into Syria is because we're going to use them, right? And we're going to use them starting the day after tomorrow, on the 30th of September last year. Now, that turned the tide. And to his credit, Obama said, well, let's see if we can cooperate with the Russians. And he told Kerry and Putin told Lavrov, get together, deconflict, make sure that we don't run into each other in the air, make sure that we don't shoot each other down. They did, and over the last couple of months, they've done more than deconflict. They are beginning to cooperate now in a military sense in Syria. That is the good news, and it's very, very good news. Now, what's the problem? Well, the problem has to do with the folks that we don't really control quite as well as would be the case if we weren't selling billions and billions of arms to them. Saudi Arabia. Now, people say, well, why do American politicians and statespeople, why do they get so nervous and have to go to the bathroom when Saudi Arabia is mentioned? Well, the reason is that our arms manufacturers have offered $100 billion, that's B with a B, B as in boy, billion dollars worth of arms to Saudi Arabia.
That's a lot of billions.
During the Obama administration. Okay, now, yeah, you say that's a lot of billions. What I say, well, the answer I get on that is, oh, McGovern, for God's sake, you don't exaggerate. Only $50 billion has been approved. I have to say, you know, I don't think that the adjective or the adverb only is at all appropriate before the before $50 billion, okay? It isn't. So that's the sum and substance of what is, exists in the relationship with Saudi Arabia. With respect to Turkey, it's a little bit different. The Turks hate Bashar al-Assad from many, many years. They'd like to get rid of him. They'd like to have more influence.
Let me jump in here about the Turks, because here we have President Obama meeting with the General Secretary of NATO, but the President of Turkey, Erdogan, was also here, and President Obama, unlike last time, didn't meet with him. He snubbed him, and NATO's eastern flank, of course, is Turkey, and Turkey has been a real dominant facilitator of the armed struggle against Bashar al-Assad, allowing ISIS and ISIL, Daesh, and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and all of the other terrorist organizations to use Turkey as a transit point for weapons and money and fighters and transport of oil revenues out of Syria. We know that now. There was a lot of speculation about it, but there's a lot of mounting evidence. President Erdogan has continued to sort of not go with the program, even though on a formal basis he may have. What accounts for that? Is that a new division in NATO? Because Turkey is a big military and the eastern flank, the neighbor of Syria. What's going on between the U.S. and Turkey, its NATO ally?
Well, Erdogan is a loose cannon. He shot down a Russian fighter bomber. It was pre-planned. It was all very, very expertly executed. Whether that fighter bomber did violate Turkish airspace for 10, 15, 20 seconds or whatever they claimed is problematical. Shut the plane down. Turkey under Erdogan shows every evidence of just kind of being very, very blasé about getting a war started between NATO and Russia. Now, in present circumstances, that could not be more dangerous. That could be not more irresponsible. And so what is he doing? Well, he's doing everything he can to keep the pot boiling. Whether or not he and the Saudis will cease and desist now that Lavrov and Kerry have come to a very decent cessation of hostilities agreement, that remains to be seen. But, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. Erdogan is an unguided missile. Not only that, but he has manifested, and I'll use the word, fascist tendencies within his country. A newspaper writes an unflattering editorial, the editor gets put in jail.
Yeah, shutting down newspapers, big newspapers, or replacing the editor. I mean, a lot of journalists in jail right now in Turkey.
Yeah, not only that, but parliamentarians. Now, very briefly, that sarin attack, the gas attack outside of Damascus on the 21st of August 2013 that almost had Obama pressing the button for overt war on Syria? It was the Turks that did that. That was Turkish intelligence that facilitated the movement of the precursors of sarin gas from Europe through Turkey down to where it was fired outside Damascus.
Help us. That's major. So what's your evidence on that?
Well, the evidence, such as it is much better than ever before. In December, two Turkish parliamentarians, with court records in hand, testified before the Turkish parliament saying 5 to 8 people were caught smuggling these chemicals into Syria from Turkey. They were wrapped up, they were indicted, and they were just about to go to trial when higher authority from Ankara said, no, judge, dismiss those guys, let them go back to Syria. The people who exposed this information, and as I say, it's documentary material, it's court records, pointed to the fact that they were reasonably certain that that's the kind of chemical transit that permitted the rebels, such as they are, in outside of Damascus to concoct this sarin, this homemade sarin, and we know now that it was homemade, not the sarin from Syrian army government stocks, and perpetrate this incident so that the neocons could go to President Obama and say, look, you warned, you set a red line, you said, and even the movement of chemical weapons, much less their use, would make you change your military calculations. Now you gotta attack Syria. Well, thank goodness we had a Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff with a conscience. He went to Obama after Kerry pretty much declared war on Syria and said, look, Mr. Obama, it's not that simple. That sarin, we know now from our British friends who have run it through their laboratories, that sarin was homemade. It was not the same that Bashar al-Assad's army has in their stock. So what we have now, the new news here is in December, these Turkish parliamentarians came forward. Now, what did Erdogan do? He said, this is traitorous. We should prosecute these people. And given the state of Western coverage of such things, there's not been a thing in the newspaper about this, and I don't read Turkish, okay? So I don't know if this fellow, the parliamentarian whose name is Aaron Erdem, whether he's in jail, whether he's still alive, whether this can still be an issue pressed in Ankara, because it's a terribly important. The United States almost being mousetrapped into a war on false pretenses sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, I want to just emphasize this for our audience. We're talking with Ray McGovern. We're talking about NATO and the meeting on Monday between Secretary General of NATO Jens Stoltenberg with President Obama. I just want to emphasize, Ray, what you just said, because I think it's like it has to be recognized for what it is. You have NATO, a Turkey ally in NATO, the eastern flank of NATO, setting up the United States government with a false sarin gas attack. And then you had Secretary of State John Kerry, who historically wasn't recognized as a neoconservative, but maybe that's wrong. Maybe there's not a big distinction. Demanding, along with the Washington Post, that President Obama make the decision to go to war against Syria on the basis that a red line had been crossed. President Obama obviously set that red line, thinking Syria would never do something so stupid as to use chemical weapons, because that would invite foreign intervention. And they were, and at that time, Syria was seeming to be stable or starting to at least hold on militarily against the terrorists. That would have been undone by foreign military intervention. And then you have Erdogan, the Turkish government, setting this up with the complicity, it would seem to me, of the State Department, or at least the State Department joined in afterwards as part of the war chorus. Obama stepped back at the last minute after the British said, no, we're not going to go along. And after public opinion was running, you know, gargantuan numbers against intervention. Why wouldn't that be the focus of a meeting between NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg and President Obama, if we have, as you said, documentary evidence that this was mousetrap operation was underway? I mean, that's pretty big.
It is big. And Stoltenberg should know about this. And this will sound strange to you, Brian, but I have no guarantee that anybody's told Stoltenberg about this. And the press in Western Europe is just as bad as our press. So the fact that we have Turkish parliamentarians going way out on a limb saying this happened and it was our fault and it was the fault of our own intelligence service, the fact that that should be news to 95% of Americans and maybe even Stoltenberg, depressingly, that doesn't surprise me. Now, let me just draw something from personal experience because I think it speaks volumes. On the 9th of September, 7 days or 8 days after this thing went down, where Obama said, I'm not going to attack Syria, I'm going to go to the Congress to get appropriate authorization, I am at the top of the CNN building here in Washington, and I'm giving a little interview, CNN International. I come out, open the door. Oops, I almost knock over this little guy. It's Paul Wolfowitz.
That was your moment.
Yeah, well, I said to myself, thank God I've had all this nonviolence training, you know. Anyhow, long story short, he and Joe Lieberman were both there. They looked like their mothers had just been run over by a Mack truck.
They didn't get the war they had been planning.
And they went over and they went to a different studio and they had this thing. And the first thing Lieberman says, this is cowardly. The president knows that he doesn't need congressional proof or get congressional authorization to wage a war on Syria. He didn't, you know. So I wait for them in the elevator shaft. And as they come out, I say, Joe, Paul, how are you? And in Washington, you can't ever, you know, ever think that you don't recognize somebody who might be important ahead of time at the time, you know. So I said, now, Joe, I've gone to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. I ripped it out here for you and annotated it. You know, if you don't know that only Congress has the right to authorize a war, well, you really should know that after 24 years in Congress. So here, why don't you take this? And Wolfowitz is slinking away, right? And then the beautiful 10-foot, no, she's not 10, 6-foot beautiful woman who's supposed to be minding Wolfowitz and Lieberman to make sure they don't encounter any hoi polloi like me. She says, oh, gentlemen, I'm so sorry. I looked at her and said, yeah, I'm sorry too. Why do you get these clowns on? Don't know what the U.S. Constitution says. Well, that was the last time I've been on CNN, but it was worth it.
Well, and of course, that's the whole thing about these neoconservative war makers. It's not them and it's not their children who are doing the bleeding. It's not people they know. It's other people who are doing that. It's very easy to go to war. And of course, the Constitution of the United States does say that only Congress can declare war, although since World War II's inception, that congressional mandate and obligation has never been fully implemented. But it was an amazing period in American history, I think, because it looked inevitable that the United States was about to go to war against Syria based on these, what you say, documentary evidence of really a setup, a mousetrap. And just think of what might have happened, Ray McGovern, if the U.S. had been starting a major war against Syria in August, September 2013. I mean, the Iran nuclear negotiations would not have happened. Iran would have been come into that war as an ally of Syria, likely. The whole regional vision would have been completely different from what it is today.
Yeah, but it would have been good for one country, Israel, the country to which Joe Lieberman and Paul Wolfowitz are inordinately devoted, okay? Israel was afraid that Assad might win that war, okay? And that's why they dearly wanted the U.S. to come in, because they knew that would prevent that, okay? That's really big. Yeah, the other thing I'll say is there's also new evidence about this sarin attack. It came out of Jeffrey Goldberg's interview, extensive interviews with President Obama. And Obama is recounting the fact that James Clapper, the head of national intelligence, came to him during this period and said, "Now, Mr. President, the sarin attack outside Damascus, I know that John Kerry is saying it was the Syrian government, but just so you know, how do I say this? It's not a slam dunk, Mr. President. It's not a slam dunk." Well, hello, that's so transparent. They didn't have the evidence then, just like they don't have the evidence on the MH17 shootdown. This is a travesty. And Obama is pretty much acquiescing in all this stuff, which is a terrific disappointment to me.
We have been talking for the full hour with Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst. He is a political activist. He's a journalist. You can read his writings, his analysis, excellent work on raymcgovern.com. You have been listening to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.